This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. In West Texas, distances define everything. It's the space between towns, the space between neighbors, and most critically, the space between a person in crisis and the help they need. Abilene led the way on addressing the gap, and now Texas is one of the few states in the nation modeling an alternative approach to policing when it comes to people experiencing a mental health crisis. Over the next 5 weeks, we'll bring you a deep dive. Today, KACU's Josiah Wannell begins by looking into the problem.
In Abilene, a quiet crisis has been building for decades. It doesn't make the front page. It doesn't draw a crowd. But it is there every time a police cruiser is dispatched to a home at 3 a.m. because a son is hearing voices or a daughter is spiraling into a darkness her parents don't understand. By the late 2010s, the Abilene Police Department realized they were responding to thousands of calls that had nothing to do with crime and everything to do with a medical system that had simply run out of room. We have reached a point where the county jail is the largest psychiatric facility in the region. To understand how we got here, we have to look at the system we inherited. This isn't a new problem. It's a 60-year-old ghost. In 1963, President John F. Kennedy signed the Community Mental Health Act. The vision was bold: empty the overcrowded state hospitals and treat people in their own communities. But then the world changed. Professor Brian Shannon has spent over three decades teaching mental health law at Texas Tech University. He explains what happened when the funding never followed the vision.
The last act that President Kennedy signed before he died was a comprehensive community mental health bill to try and help establish community-based authorities or services for people with mental health issues in the community. The dollars just didn't follow.
What did follow is a gap. People instead filled the streets, the emergency rooms, and eventually the jails. Professor Shannon calls what happened next something worse than failure.
We've almost seen in this country, in our state, a trans-institutionalization going from one type of state facility, the state hospital system, into the jails and prisons, often because of a lack of adequate community care.
Judge Steve Lifeman watched this transfer happen in real time. After three decades on the bench in Miami-Dade County, he has become one of the nation's foremost authorities on mental health and the justice system. When he started his career as a public defender, the picture looked different.
When I started, there was probably one wing of one floor housing people with mental illnesses in all of Miami-Dade County. By the time I had become a judge, we had three of nine floors housing people with mental illnesses.
Three of nine floors. And that main floor had a name.
We had this notorious mental health floor in the jail called the ninth floor, which had been renamed by a reporter as the forgotten floor. It was abusive. It was overcrowded. The corrections officers were not trained well. There was a lot of abuse going on, and it was a nightmare.
The ninth floor was not an anomaly. It was a mirror held up to a system that had chosen to route people with serious mental illness through criminal justice rather than health care.
Instead of recognizing that we had put a lot of people at risk, both with and without mental illnesses, and developing a system that actually worked for this population, we decided we would use the criminal justice system as a way to deal with it.
And when the system could no longer pretend it was working, Judge Lifeman found himself staring at the failure from the bench and forced to make an impossible choice.
And that my only option was to release him back to the street and tell him to go get help. It was a joke.
He doesn't say it with anger. He says it with the exhausted clarity of someone who has repeated it a thousand times, hoping someone will hear it.
The system was set up to fail, and it failed perfectly.
If the national crisis is a storm in rural West Texas, it's a hurricane with nowhere to make landfall. In an urban center, you might have a psychiatric emergency room, a dedicated crisis line, a mobile response team. In the big country, you have distance and silence. Professor Shannon has seen it firsthand.
And so you've got a lot of wide open spaces, counties I've sometimes even heard referred to as frontier counties.
In frontier counties, there is often no immediate alternative to a police response. No crisis center, no mobile unit, no clinician on call. Just a dispatcher, a patrol car, and an officer trying to do a job they were never fully trained for. Dr. Andy Keller is the president and CEO of the Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute. He has spent his career building systems that get ahead of a crisis rather than react to it. He warns that when police are dispatched to a mental health crisis without clinical support, the situation becomes dangerous, not because anyone intends harm, but because the tools don't match the problem.
If you only send a police officer and they have limited help and they have limited training, you could have an argument break out. You know, if I kind of, the paramedic goes to shake my hand and I take my hand away like this, the paramedic's probably not going to charge me with resisting arrest. But if the officer does and they don't have, and there it's a bad day for them and I pull my hand away too hard, who knows how that escalates? So why even put the officer in that situation? They don't want to be in that situation.
Nobody wants to be in that situation. Not the officer, not the family, and certainly not the person in crisis, who, in many cases, has no idea they're sick at all. Before Texas could build a solution, it had to reckon with the truth it had been quietly avoiding. This wasn't just a system under strain. It was a system pointed in the wrong direction entirely. The tools were wrong, the training was wrong, and for a long time, the conversation itself was forbidden. Professor Shannon remembers when mental illness wasn't something you just named out loud.
When my brother first got ill, there was still a great deal of stigma. There's still some today, but persons with a diagnosed mental illness, you didn't talk about it. There was concern that, you know, maybe it's because I've been a bad person, or there was even this, you know, maybe there was bad parenting, a lot of misunderstanding.
For decades, that misunderstanding shaped policy. It shaped who got help and who got arrested instead. But Shannon has witnessed something slowly.
I've seen a big shift since I was first involved in this area with broader openness to discussing mental health issues.
And with that openness came a harder question. The question that leaders in Abilene began asking under Police Chief Stan Stanrich. Not how do we control this, but how do we care for this? That question would eventually change everything. But first, the system had to be willing to say, plainly, out loud, what it had become and what it was costing.
You can continue to do what you do now, which is releasing people without treatment. That accomplishes nothing, makes matters worse, wastes taxpayer dollars, threatens public safety, or you can release people with treatment.
That is the choice that Texas began to make. I'm Josiah Winnell in Abilene.
In episode 2, we follow the people who decided to make it differently. We look at the co-responders program, the court diversion docket, and the implementation of assisted outpatient treatment, tools built not to punish a crime, but to treat one. This series was produced with assistance from the Public Media Journalists Association Editor Corps, funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. West Texas has become a popular site for AI data center projects, but residents and some city governments have questions they want answered before the proposals get approved. Lubbock is the largest city in the region that has not yet approved a data center project. KTTZ's Charlie Moranville spoke to Lubbock City Manager, who says while data centers aren't completely ruled out, the process will require collaboration and transparency.
In late January, a zoning plan to build a data center in the city of Lubbock was scrapped. Lubbock developer Terry Holman of Hugo Reed & Associates told the Planning and Zoning Commission in the January meeting that the developer had already built data centers in other West Texas towns.
This project is a proposed data center. It's the cloud. It's processing of large amounts of internet data, which requires large amounts of power.
John Osborne, president and CEO of the Lubbock Economic Development Alliance, spoke on the water needs of the proposed facility as bringing new infrastructure to the area.
We can bring a water line over there to East Lubbock that will actually enable some additional water and stabilities over in far East Lubbock.
Members of the community from the NAACP and the North and East Lubbock Coalition spoke against the project bringing additional industrial development to the area, and the Planning and Zoning Commission voted against the project.
So motion fails 4-3.
The developers went back to the drawing board, and many from the Lubbock community celebrated both the decision and the feeling that their voices were heard. Months later, the community and city know that this was not the first or the last developer that will come into Lubbock looking for a place to house a data center. The city continues to collect information about these projects and the best way to help their community with or without a data center. Lubbock City Manager Jarrett Atkinson focuses on the zoning and utility details of these data centers and many other aspects.
Data center is a business like any others. Now, it's got its own unique characteristics and concerns. Agreed. So I think it's important to understand, and this is on the data center, where do you want to put it? Is that location an appropriate place to put it? And by that I mean, is it going to cause an outsized issue with its neighbors?
When looking at what data centers will bring to Lubbock, Atkinson says the city's number one question that they hear is usually about water, and adds that Lubbock has worked with developers on these concerns and is making sure that they are asking these questions.
You know, what would the demand of your particular facility be? Not necessarily the day you open it. A lot of these are built in phases. So what does it look like at full development? If one of them locates here and it's good and appropriate for all parties, want it to be successful.
Atkinson explains that the community of Lubbock's water bill will not be directly affected if a data center is built. Residents of Abernathy, a town about 17 miles north of Lubbock, just found out they will be getting a data center that is expected to be finished in 2027. The developer, Align Data Centers, has been transparent with water questions. This developer says they are working with Abernathy to protect the Ogallala Aquifer and the town's supply of resources. The next time a developer brings their plans to Lubbock, the city wants to hear all the ways that both the developer and the city could benefit. Data centers have not been taken off the table, but Atkinson says the city wants to be involved in the planning.
I would encourage people that want to develop data center projects or to propose the development of a data center project. I think the more they work with the city staff up front, you know, before it gets to that point, I think the better.
One aspect that Atkinson says the city does not have a lot of information on is the energy component. In 2024, Lubbock finalized the switch from a municipal energy provider, Lubbock Power and Light, to the commercial electricity market for its residents. After becoming fully integrated to the statewide grid managed by the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT, in 2024, Atkinson says the city keeps their ears open for information about what other towns and organizations have been hearing and what their courses of action have been. If another developer comes in with new plans, Atkinson encourages the community to bring their questions and concerns to the zoning meetings, like in January.
I would congratulate the people that came out in January and tell them to do exactly the same thing.
In January, the Lubbock community showed up to the zoning meetings and had their statements ready. The community is able to voice their concerns at every step of this process at these meetings, zoning and city council. When bringing a development plan to the city of Lubbock, the developers must present it to the Planning and Zoning Commission, and then the plans move to the city council to be approved. If they are not recommended at the zoning meeting, they can still be passed by the city council through public hearings, where citizens have no time limit for sharing their opinion.
Everybody can come. So I think that we've got some pretty good education amongst the public of how to do that and encourage them to keep doing it, and not just for a data center project. We have that same opportunity on any kind of a zoning issue. And again, before any zone change ever got approved, it's done twice, two completely different public hearings.
City leaders continue to encourage new development, businesses, and job opportunities coming to Lubbock. But Atkinson and others also stress the importance of transparency, responsibility, and communication in that process. I'm Charlie Moranville in Lubbock.
Since construction began on the Stargate data centers in early 2025, Abilene's housing market has increasingly been under pressure. It's hit every area of the rental market. It's prompted construction of several RV parks. And still, there's just not enough. Abilene's three universities are not immune to the ripple effects. We've spoken with people at all of them and bring you this look at how the housing crisis is hitting campuses. KACU's Leslie Kerrigan kicks us off with the view from ACU.
Rental prices have shot up around Abilene this year. A recent report indicates rents are 50% higher this spring compared to last year. Merritt Gammertsfelder is a junior at Abilene Christian University. She says she was forced to move houses after her landlord raised her rent last fall.
Mid-November, we get this notice from my landlord, and it's just be like, to the house of blah, 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 blah. Your monthly rent will adjust from $2,100 to $2,800. This reflects the current market rates and helps us keep up with ongoing maintenance and property costs.
Gammertsfelder says that when she initially moved into the house, she was planning to live there for her last 2 years of college. But this increased her individual rent from $525 a month plus utilities to $700 plus utilities, meaning she would need to move houses again this summer.
I'm just a college student. How dare you make you? People know that we're broke. People know that we're paying so much money, even just to go to ACU.
It's a common complaint. Landlords at managed complexes and individually rented units are ending leases, claiming they need to renovate and raising their rates. ACU has been working to find solutions to the much higher need for student housing. According to Kevin Campbell, Senior Vice President for Operations at ACU, 150 students who applied were not able to get into campus apartments this school year. And this year, more upperclassmen have been interested in on-campus housing than ever before.
We're thinking of this in both short-term and long-term. So what can we do right now for the students who need housing today? And how do we help create additional capacity to help the same situation next year?
Campbell says the issue is a simple supply and demand problem and says his team is working hard on a multi-pronged approach.
We have been able to purchase a few additional houses here in the neighborhood near campus. And so we are trying to renovate those and refresh those and get those ready for students. And so, you know, for the last several weeks, I've actually purchased a house a week for the last several weeks.
Housing leadership has also partnered with the loft apartments near campus to reduce rent for ACU students. University leadership is considering opening up dorms meant for sophomores to juniors and seniors, though the plan is still under review. And this summer, ACU is breaking ground on new apartments that will hold 150 students. But those units will not be completed until September, meaning students interested in living there will need to find housing for the beginning of the semester. In the meantime, Campbell says they're asking students to share their stories.
We are trying to hear more from students. We've tried to be more proactive and asking students questions, trying to better understand who has secured housing and who has not secured housing. We're going to do our best to walk alongside every student that does not have housing, that needs housing, to see what ways can we use our relationships and some of our leverage to help create the best situation we can for the students.
Merritt Gammertsfelder says she's heard lots of stories from her classmates. Many feel stuck and have chosen to pay the extra cost instead of moving.
A lot of students are just like, you know, sucking it up and like paying more money just because like a lot of us that happen are juniors and we only have one more year here. Everyone's like, oh, it's just 7 more months of rent. Like that's manageable. But people are still like really upset about it.
And even with city leaders, university officials, and developers all scrambling, the problem may not be resolved by the end of the next school year. I'm Leslie Kerrigan, and with a view from Hardin-Simmons University, here's Bailey Simon.
Hardin-Simmons University's enrollment for this year was 1,665 students. About 900 of them live on campus, up about 4% over last year, while the freshman class grew only about 1% this year. And demand for on-campus housing will likely grow even more for the 2026 to 2027 school year. The university requires students to live on campus for a total of 3 semesters before they can move off campus, but now many upperclassmen are trying to secure on-campus housing beyond the initial requirement, even in the summer. Administrators were unavailable for an interview, but in an email to KACU, Vice President of Student Life Stacy Martin said that the university has experienced a 34% increase in summer housing requests from last summer, and that its summer housing is currently at capacity. More graduate students are also looking to return to campus next fall, along with more returning undergrads. Ada McCutcheon says on-campus housing is the cheapest option in town, but she notes that upperclassmen don't have a guaranteed spot.
The dorms are usually fine, but the on-campus apartments, it's hard to get into right now because everybody's wanting to live on the on-campus apartments. There's nothing available off-campus even, and so housing is definitely like a big issue right now.
For McCutcheon, it's a matter of convenience.
My parents actually live like 30 minutes outside of town, and even then I choose to live on campus. It's just easier that way.
Even with the housing prices increasing, some students are opting to live off campus. As a freshman, Will Grisham currently lives in a dorm, but he says he will probably move to a house with his football teammates as soon as he is able to.
Just a little bit more freedom, you know, and get to cook and do the things that we like to do, you know, away from everybody else, kind of do our own things.
However, Grisham says some of his older teammates have advised him to live on campus for as long as he can.
We've had a couple of friends tell us that, you know, it's just worth the wait. The prices are skyrocketing, you know. Paying rent for them is getting outrageous. You know, a lot of people say, don't grow up, stay young as long as you can. In the same way, those of our friends are telling us, you know, don't get out of the off campus while you can, you know, stay in there as long as you can.
While some students like Grisham may desire more independence, they want to consider some of the other benefits of living on campus. Not only the convenience, but having utilities and other fees included in the housing cost. Looking at next school year, HSU is raising dorm rates between $50 and $300 per semester. Some of HSU's apartments will also see an increase, but University Place apartments will remain flat, between $2,450 and $3,800 per student. Even with the slight increase, those rates are a better deal than most students would be able to find on Abilene's rental market. I'm Bailey Simon. Up next, we hear from Kaysen Higgins, who checked out the situation at McMurry University.
McMurry University sits on the north side of Abilene with roughly 1,100 students, and unlike some of its neighbors, the school has largely been able to shield its students from Abilene's tightening rental market. That's largely because of capacity. Grant Greenwood, McMurry's chief operating officer and vice president for enrollment management, says the university operates about 700 beds on campus, and they fill up fast.
In the fall, we're pretty close to 100% and maybe ticking over a hair over 100%. So we're pretty full, our campus.
For students who do live off campus, the picture looks different. Abilene's rental market has tightened considerably in recent years, making it harder for anyone on a student budget to find something affordable close to campus.
There's fewer rentals because there's more demand, there's more people, more transient workers in Abilene. And so that's driving the inventory down and the prices up.
McMurry's on-campus capacity has helped buffer students from the worst of that squeeze. University officials says no students have been lost to housing challenges so far, in part because McMurry leans heavily on financial aid to keep students on campus and in the classroom.
We're typically one of the most affordable private institutions, not only with sticker price, but we also offer really competitive aid packages as well for students.
Still, affordability remains front of mind for administration, not just tuition, but the full cost of attending, including housing, books, and everyday expenses. McMurry says providing social mobility for its students is a core priority, and reducing that financial burden is central to that mission. For many students, the ability to live on campus isn't just a convenience, it's what makes attending possible in the first place. As for the future, the university has growth aspirations, and Greenwood says if enrollment climbs, McMurry is already thinking ahead about where to put students, including exploring property acquisition around campus for new student housing.
If we have more students on campus, we need to find a way to add more of those opportunities for students to live.
I'm Kaysen Higgins in Abilene.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. The latest data for a pound of ground beef, $6.70 on average. A sirloin steak runs about $14 a pound. As the Texas Standard's Michael Marks reports, buying a whole or half cow directly from a rancher could make more financial sense.
I'm in Casey Ginnert's tidy garage in Canyon Lake in Central Texas, and she's giving me a tour of her freezer.
Okay, so I like to organize. So at the top, we have mostly, we've got beef flank, we've got any roast I have, we've got the osso buco.
It is packed, mostly with beef. She's got roasts, ribs, steaks, and a whole trove of her favorite cut.
This third row, this is literally nothing but beef tenderloin. Is that not the most beautiful thing you've ever seen?
These will last Ginnert and her partner more than a year, and these are folks who eat beef about 5 nights a week. They ordered the meat in bulk from a ranch about 75 miles east called Bastrop Cattle Company. Buying meat direct from a rancher is not a new concept, but the industry boomed thanks to COVID. Back then, grocery stores couldn't keep their coolers stocked, and customers wanted to know they'd have a stable meat supply. Before the pandemic, Bastrop Cattle Company had been selling their grass-fed beef to restaurants. Here's one of the owners, Max Kremke.
And then 2020 happened, and we were the only ones, one of the few places that was still able to process because we're small, and then we were able to sell to the public, and we had a decent website. And so ever since then, it's kind of just been direct to customer only.
The cattle crowd in the shade about 50 yards away from us, munching and mooing, some of them just a few days old. Kremke says that buying a whole cow from a rancher like him used to be a more complex process.
You'd buy the cow from the rancher live weight, then go to the butcher, and then it would turn into a hanging weight, which is with all the inedible parts removed. Then you pay a processing fee, you pay a kill fee, give cutting instructions.
Now, customers don't have to think about all that. They pick how much beef they want, decide how they want it cut, with Kremke's help, and then pay one fee. It's over $2,000 for a half cow and nearly $4,000 for a whole. That's a lot of money. But with retail beef prices still near record highs, it might end up cheaper than the grocery store, which is even a surprise to Kremke.
I remember the exact moment whenever somebody said to me, oh, we did the numbers, and actually we think it'll save us money. And I was like, oh, okay, that's wild.
Smaller operations like Kremke's pay more than big meat packers to process, package, and ship their food, which gets passed on to the customer. But as beef prices go up in stores, buying in bulk from a rancher becomes a better deal.
I think that you probably were paying a premium to be purchasing the more local products in bulk. My hypothesis is that that gap has shrunk a little bit.
That's Erin Beyer, extension meat specialist for Kansas State University. She says there are caveats. You have to have enough money to pay for the beef up front and a freezer to store it all. Beyer says some people who bought a whole cow during the pandemic got more than they bargained for.
That was a big issue from the beginning of, oh, I bought a half of beef or a quarter of beef, and then they would get it, right? And they have one small chest freezer. There's no way that's going to fit.
Back in Canyon Lake, Casey Ginnert likes how buying a few hundred pounds of beef at a time shields her from fluctuations in price.
Once you buy it at that price, if it goes up because something's going on political science-wise, whatever, my pricing has stayed the same, at least for a good year, year and a half.
Ginnert has not penciled out exactly how much money she's saving, but after buying three orders from Bastrop Cattle Company, she's convinced it's the way to go.
The upfront cost is a little painful, but it is worth it in the long run. And just think that you're not going to see beef probably for a good year to year and a half on your grocery bill. And that makes a huge difference.
She says this is how she'll buy beef from now on. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Michael Marks.
Got another 40th flashback for you. Many of our students head to jobs in other cities after graduation. We've seen some of our alumni head to other sides of the world. Today, we hear from former host Erin Pakluta.
Good morning, afternoon, and evening. I am Erin Pakluta. I was an announcer for the station from 2015 to 2018 while I was a student at Abilene Christian University. You're listening to 89.5 KACU. I started out on Morning Edition in 2015, and by the autumn of 2017, I transitioned over to the day shift, contributing to All Things Considered. Sleep patterns aside, it was great to have a chance to see the full picture of what goes into our modern media, from the notepad all the way to the editing suite. One of my favorite memories from KACU came very early on. About a week after I was hired, I had the opportunity to fly with the U.S. Army parachute team. It was one of those moments where you realize very quickly this is not just a student job. You are out there, representing the station, telling real stories, and sometimes doing things just outside of your comfort zone. What working at KACU really taught me was how to construct a story with intention, to find the facts, understand them completely, and then deliver them with clarity to the community. That idea, that the economy of language matters, has stayed with me even beyond Abilene. After graduating, that foundation took me overseas to Japan, where I spent several years from 2019 to 2025 pursuing rugby at a professional level in varying capacities. During that time, I also had the opportunity to work with the First Lady of Japan, Akie Abe, during the 2019 Rugby World Cup, which was truly a unique experience. It combined international sports and diplomacy in a way I never could have predicted. These days, I'm still based in Japan, nearby Tokyo. I continue to play rugby at a semi-professional level, and I work as a sports analyst for an international company. In a lot of ways, the work I do now still connects back to what I learned at KACU, being able to process information quickly, understand its context, and deliver it in a way that makes sense to someone who may or may not have the same background. Looking back, KACU is more than just a station for Abilene. It's a proving ground. It's a place where students like myself learn not just how to report, but how to think, how to listen, and how to tell the stories that matter. Serving the big country through reporting, telling the stories of our community, was one of the greatest privileges I've ever had. It's something I carry with me, no matter where I am in the world. So to everyone at KACU, past, present, and future, happy 40th anniversary. And thank you for giving me and so many others a foundation that has carried us across the world. Through your support, these community stations will continue to thrive and teach generation after generation of students. Once more with feeling, you're listening to 89.5 KACU.
It's time for West Texas Roots. Most people have a story of visiting a zoo, but rarely do the words human pathologist show up in them. For Carol Lee Trotter Armstrong, pathology is key to her Abilene Zoo story. She recalls the incident that helped make her father the president of the Abilene Zoological Society and how she was born in a hallway at Hendrick Hospital.
Well, the Abilene Zoo used to be at what was called Fair Park when I was born. It is now Rose Park. The round building you see and the squattier maintenance building used to be part of the zoo. That the round building is where the food was kept. My father had just come to Abilene in 1960, and around 1963, they called them because Charlie the chimpanzee was going bananas at the zoo. And the vet wasn't in town, but for some reason they thought a pathologist, a human pathologist, could handle this. So my father drove down, looked at Charlie, asked about his daily routine, and told them, he's addicted to cigarettes because you people let people, visitors, give this monkey cigarettes. He's now addicted, and when he doesn't get the cigarettes, he has withdrawals. This led to my father later becoming president of the Zoological Society because he would do autopsies, although it's called a necroscopy, on animals from them. And when the first polar bear died, he diagnosed him with hypertension because they gave him too many salt blocks. There is not an off button on a polar bear. But happily, my dad and our family have kept up with the Abilene Zoo. He got to cut the ribbon and invite everybody to the new zoo at Nelson Park. But yeah, don't feed your polar bears salt blocks, people. Hendricks. My mother was pregnant at Hendricks, and there was a beautiful OBGYN named Dr. Busby, who was a lovely man. I was to be born March 30th. My birthday is April the 12th. Needless to say, things weren't working. So in the old East Wing, where you had labor and delivery, they finally decided my mother was going to need a cesarean. She was very upset, and sweet Dr. Busby started going home. 20 minutes later, my mother said, I think that baby's on the way. The nurses said, oh, Peggy, I don't think so, honey. So the next thing, they looked and said, call Busby. So as they were wheeling my mother into the labor and delivery theater, my mother looked down the hall Sweet Dr. Busby was in a pair of polka dot boxers trying to put on his white scrubs, and she laughed so hard, I was born in the hallway of Hendrick Hospital.
We recorded Carol Lee Trotter Armstrong's story of how her father became president of the Abilene Zoological Society at the Taylor County Expo Center. This is the West Texas Dispatch. If you listen to the West Texas Dispatch frequently, which you should, you're bound to have heard Paul Fabrizio on here. Frankly, if you've caught any news at all in the big country, though, you've heard him or seen his name. He's been a mainstay on the airwaves ever since he came to Abilene to teach political science at McMurray University in the mid-90s. Well, in about a week from now, Paul will be retiring from teaching at McMurray, and Paul Fabrizio joins us in the studio. Paul, are you looking forward to retirement?
I actually am. I really am. 30 years teaching at McMurray. I came in 96. I'll leave in 2026. That's enough.
Exactly 30 years.
Yeah, 30 years.
Okay, you've been involved in so many debates, so many town halls, political interviews over the years. You have seen a lot. What are some of the things that you saw in West Texas that you're never going to forget politically?
That's a hard question.
Yeah, right off the bat, too.
When I think about West Texas, and especially Abilene, what strikes me the most is that it's nice. Mm. And it's hard to say that about politics, because politics, in the end, is a deadly serious game. But there's not an edge that I see when I watch politics in other places. And it doesn't work in every campaign. But for the most part, people here, when they're running for office, try to be nice.
Do you think it's because they feel like they can't get away with being mean here?
That's what I always hope.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's not like there's somebody who's going to pass judgment on them.
But voters kind of do.
But I think voters respond best here to people who are serious, but careful, who are polite, who don't go for the real vicious insults. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying this at a time when politics is pretty cutthroat. And so that has just fascinated me. And so when I think about controversies that have taken place in this area, I always feel okay about them, because I don't feel like my morals have been thrown against the wall or a stump down or anything like that. I feel like, okay, they are taking into account who we are as people, and they are realizing that to succeed, to be successful, you got to be nice.
30 years is a decent amount of time. Do you think in 30 years you've seen a shift in the political climate, in the landscape, I should say, here?
Yeah. I would say there's been a real shift, because you go back when I arrived, the Congressman Charles Stenholm, a Democrat, was the dominant person. But within 10 years of my arriving here, he lost, retired, became a lobbyist, and we have gone Republican since then. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Republicans who've run have become more and more MAGA.
Yeah.
For searching for a word that would describe them, I think. And so they're less and less establishment Republican. But despite that, I would still argue that there's a niceness about it, even though there's people still desperately want to win.
What about your students? You've seen, you know, young minds have changed, I would assume, somewhat over 30 years. Or are they the same?
I think the students are largely the same. Yeah. Number one, they aren't that interested in politics. I discovered very, very quickly when I came here that the way to be a successful professor of political science was I had to motivate my students. If I motivated them, then the rest was easy. Then they got interested. And what I realized is the way to motivate them is to get them interested in the news. What's happening? Yeah. And look, there's so many stories that are going on, so many things you can follow at the local level, state level, the national level, that there's something for each student to really get excited about, to pay attention to. You know, today it could be Pete Hegseth, Donald Trump, could be Greg Abbott, it could be Stan Lambert and his campaign, it could be any of those things that would be interesting. And so my job was to get the students interested in what's happening in the larger world. And as soon as that happened, rest is easy.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, you think about adults and they say that politics is your checkbook, right? Yeah. That's what makes you political being.
Right.
Well, those kids don't have their own checkbooks. No. It's mom and dad's.
No. And I got a big surprise this year. I'm teaching and I'm talking about, you know, what took place January 6th, 2021, the insurrection. And the students didn't know what it was.
No.
And then I realized they were in junior high school. And I know. And that was a real shock. They were 13, 12 years old. And it's like, yeah, they probably weren't paying attention to the news in those days. And so that whole situation just doesn't mean anything to them. And so I have to spend time talking about it. And it reminds me so much of what took place after 2001, 9/11. Big deal. I still have students coming up to me who were my students on 9/11, and they remember it distinctly. But 10 years later, what happened on 9/11?
Right, right.
I saw a film about that.
Yeah.
You know, it lacked the immediacy.
I don't want to end on a negative note, but looking at how divided we are, do you have hope for the future for America, or are you worried?
I'm worried, but
can
I hold two different thoughts? Yeah. I very much am hopeful, because if you look at American history, we have been divided before. We all who study politics consider the nastiest election to be the election for the presidency in 1800 between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. Okay, two of our founding fathers. So if that was an ugly election, the ugliest in American history, what's going on right now, I think we can survive.
Perspective. I love that. Before we leave, I want to say one thing to you. I've worked with you for probably 20, more than 20 years
on a long time.
Debates and interviews and everything else. We have had long political discussions over those years. And my biggest compliment that I can give to you, Paul Fabrizio, is this. To this day, I do not know if you are a Republican or a Democrat. And I think for an educator who teaches in political science, that's a heck of a thing.
Well, thank you. Paul thank Fabrizio, you very much.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, George. I so appreciate this.
Paul Fabrizio, political science professor, soon to be retiree. From everyone here at the West Texas Dispatch, we wish you the very best.
Thank you.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back Wednesday at noon. Plan to join us. And you can always catch up on the news of West Texas with the podcast. West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Just type in the name. You can also find it on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from our team of producers, executive producer Heather Claiborne, along with Shayla Conley and Caleb Leger. Our digital editor is Calvin Claiborne. Special thanks to JC Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.